friends decided to pick up their bikes or walk instead, it set up a generation to look for alternative ways to get around. As reported in the New Republic, the portion of Americans aged 16 to 24 who have driver's licenses fell to 67% in 2011, its lowest level in roughly a half century. Urban areas have seen some significant growth in bikers to work as the miles of bike-friendly roads have been dramatically increased. New York, for example, added over 500 miles of new bike paths to its roads in the last few years. Los Angeles now has 796 miles of bike lanes. Along with the bike lanes have come bike-sharing services that allow you to use a bike and return it to its stall. The largest of these was sponsored by Citibank, although its technology supplier went out of business even after having raised $50 million. The result of these developments has been impressive growth in the use of bicycles to get to work, up over 400% in cities like Washington, D.C. and Portland, Oregon. Even in a big market like San Francisco, the percentage of those who bike to work is up 300%. Garages now often have bike racks as well as spaces for gasoline-powered cars and electric vehicles. Many condos and apartment buildings in American cities once again offer bike rooms. Bikes have even become a status symbol of sorts. Whereas teens and 20-somethings have long gotten their hands dirty souping up their cars, restoring a classic bike or customizing the one you have is the new cool activity. Ultra-luxury brand Hermes sells bikes, and its Flaneur model costs an eye-popping $11,300. In China, there is a nostalgia for biking as a primary means of transportation. According to Reuters, rich Chinese are buying bicycles that cost more than the average citizen makes in 3 years, motivated by nostalgia. Zeroing in on Washington, D.C. and New York City, it's clear that bikes are changing infrastructure and our roads. However, it's still a pretty yuppie population that's using bike shares or biking to work. Even in a very diverse city like D.C., 85% of Capital bike share users are white, and around 50% of users make more than $100,000 a year. These are not people who need a bike to deliver takeout. The New York Times asks if bikes are just for rich tourists and white New Yorkers, or a public transportation system for all. While the growth has been strong, its absolute numbers are still small. Even by the generous estimates of cycling groups, bike commuting is just 2 or 3% of all local commuting. Meanwhile, billions of dollars have been spent on bicycle lanes that are often 20 or 25% of the available roadway. Anyone who sits in traffic looking at empty bicycle lanes wonders if the expenditures are really productive or sensible. Despite lots of new startups aimed at making biking easier or even shareable, the efforts aren't necessarily yielding a nation of bikers. According to the League of American Bicyclists, 2015 was the first year since 2010 that showed a decline in the number of people biking to work, despite its being the fastest-growing way to get to the office. In 2000, 43.1 million Americans rode bicycles 6 or more days, and by 2014 this had declined to 35.6 million, according to Streets.mn. Despite the up-and-down numbers, cities like Washington, D.C. are plowing ahead with further plans to make even more bike lanes. Whether they lead to a steady increase in ridership remains to be seen. The bike movement here is in many ways an adaptation of programs that appeared to work in some countries in Europe. In Germany, for example, over 80% of households have a bike. In Japan, 78%. In Thailand, 74%. Many crowded Asian cities require a bike to navigate. However, cars are also prohibitively expensive for the average person in Thailand, making a bike cheap, easy, and the obvious choice. In the U.S., only 53% of households have a bike. Interestingly, the numbers vary hugely by country. For instance, only 5% of Jordanian households have a bike, and 7% of Lebanese homes. Abroad, the U.K. has spent a lot to get Brits out of their cars and onto bikes. In 2016, London Mayor Sadiq Khan promised to inject £770 million, $978 million, of new funding over the next 5 years into improving London's cycling infrastructure and conditions. In Barcelona, the city council is planning to spend €32 million, $39 million, to triple the reach of its bike lanes by 2018. This would take the total length of bike-only throughways from 116 kilometers, 72 miles, to 308 kilometers, 191 miles. But there's a trade-off. Such moves have accelerated the traffic congestion in London, where getting across town can now routinely take an hour or more. In China, a place where riding bikes to work is common, a massive bike-sharing push has filled Chinese cities with rival companies and startups. Mobike, for instance, is a bike-sharing platform in China that reportedly receives 20 million orders per month. At the same time, one major bike-sharing company in China went bankrupt, as 90% of their bikes were stolen. Overall, China's relationship with bikes appears to be in a state of flux. Fast Company reported that while 97% of Chinese people owned a bike in 1992, by 2007 that had dropped to 49%. But just 2 years later, in 2009, ownership had risen again to 63%. Of course, if you don't get injured, biking is generally good for you. According to Reuters, the investment in biking, particularly in New York City, is making its inhabitants healthier. Every $1,300 New York City invested in building bike lanes in 2015 provided benefits equivalent to one additional year of life at full health over the lifetime of all city residents, according to a new economic assessment. A British medical journal found that over 5 years, walking and cycling versus passive modes of transport had serious medical and well-being effects. Commuters who cycled to work had a 41% lower risk of dying from all causes than people who drove or took public transport. They also had a 46% lower risk of developing and a 52% lower risk of dying from cardiovascular disease, and a 45% lower risk of developing and a 40% lower risk of dying from cancer. The benefits of walking were significant too. Walking to work was associated with a 27% lower risk of developing and a 36% lower risk of dying from cardiovascular disease. There is no question that the urban bike lane craze has been financed with huge sums of federal money. Personally, I am pessimistic about the long-term future of the trend. Mostly upper-income people in good neighborhoods who like the exercise avail themselves of these opportunities, and they seem to have a limited reach. Our society is aging. And while a young society would have more bikers, our fastest growing demo group is those over 90. Instead, ride sharing in the form of Uber Pool and similar Lyft services seems poised to provide the more efficient and cost-effective transportation breakthrough for cities, with far less danger. Mass transit also needs more investment, and bike infrastructure programs may be taking funds away from the critical needs of these aging systems. Businesses will still decide to cater to the growing bicycle marketplace and make a good living selling upscale, crunch-proof bikes with trackers in case they are stolen. That market will continue to expand, though not as rapidly as in recent years. Bike-sharing services seem to work, but mostly if a sponsor also regards them as good advertising, as bikes can easily be stolen or damaged. But if the bike will soon be competing with the driverless Uber, it's likely that the latter is going to win out. 44. Virtual entrepreneurs. The single biggest advance since the dawn of the PC for American small businesses and the mom-and-pop store is the cloud. Big business in the U.S. is moving to the cloud in record numbers, but it's smaller-scale businesses that reap enormous rewards. That is, if the leadership is savvy enough to take advantage of the technology. Small business formation is declining in the U.S., even as it has never been easier, nor more profitable, to open your own shop. Many Americans are still held back from striking out on their own because of perceived barriers and complexity. A decade ago, opening a business meant filling out endless forms for healthcare, payroll, rent, and insurance. It also required hiring someone to file paperwork in Delaware for your LLC, arranging a check run for payroll, filling out all the state, unemployment, and workers' comp. You needed to buy computers, software, the list goes on and on. By the end of this arduous process, you pretty much turned into a Republican by default, ready to slash government regulations and red tape. And even after all that, you needed to buy a server for all of your files, hire someone to back your PC hard drives, and install a security system. Today, you can open and run a small business in the course of an afternoon, without any personnel or even a server. To start a business now, you open your government accounts and numbers online, put your employee records in the cloud, and direct deposit checks. Previous time sucks, paper, HR, health insurance, claims, accounting, IT support, are all done right at your desk without assistance. Between virtual payroll companies and companies like Zenefits, the messy and annoying parts of opening a small business are transferred to people you will never talk to, let alone meet. Wireless phones will arrive in a few days, and your company credit cards come with built-in expense tracking. With a little searching online, you can find an employee handbook and a standard contract for the employees, if any, and you're ready to go. When I was 13, I opened my first business selling stamps and coins to collectors through the mail. The best place to advertise used to be the classified section of the New York Times. It was a fun business, being a teen and going to auctions, selling through the mail on approval. In those days, everything was done in person and by hand. From going to the stamp auctions, to going to the P.O. box, to collecting the returns, I was deeply involved in each step. Today, I would never leave my desk for any of these tasks. If I were running a collectibles business, I would bid in online auctions after setting up an eBay account, create online lots for sale, wait for confirmations of the credit card payments by email. If the same market existed for stamps and coins as it did when I was 13 years old, I would expect a legion of competitors. Back then, the playing field wasn't so wide. But the opening of the playing field to anyone with an entrepreneurial itch is both refreshing and encouraging. Anyone with a computer and an idea can start a business. You're less likely to be dissuaded by daunting barriers to entry, and more likely to succeed if you have a good idea. Let's imagine you want to launch a business to create t-shirts with someone's street name on them, which you could sell to your neighbors. The virtual entrepreneur in you takes over, and there's already a wealth of services that make it possible. After handling the online paperwork to set up your business, you'd be able to find a company online to make your product, something along the lines of overnighttees.com, a massive t-shirt factory that will give you a discount for quantity. You'd invest in 50 shirts for each of the neighboring 5 blocks. They would arrive overnight, and now you have to sell them. You could go door to door, or you could simply target ads on Facebook to the local area or to a list of local emails. You could hire a robocall service to blast the neighborhood with calls on the one-time offer for a t-shirt with the name of your own street right on it. With the internet enabling us, young or old, upstart Americans can become their own bosses and execute ideas that previously wouldn't have been possible. You don't even have to have a physical product to be a virtual entrepreneur. You could create an online product, a blog or website on travel, say, and add on some promotions to gain your first customers through organic and paid social. This business doesn't even have to be about humans. Look at the world of celebrity pets and pet influencers on platforms like Instagram making millions. Just film videos of your pet doing amazing things, with a little behind-the-scenes help, and start to generate a following. One couple I know turned their dog into a pet food influencer by gathering 250,000 followers on Instagram. They rake in $3,000 per ad or sponsorship. Soon their dog will be making more than they did, combined, at their previous jobs. Around 10% of all retail sales are already online. Advertising is moving there too, with the virtual storefront becoming as competitive as the traditional storefront used to be. In fact, The mark of success these days is for online brands to open up physical brick-and-mortar stores. But only after proving large levels of sales and visibility on the internet. Think Warby Parker or Casper. Both of these brands performed so well online that the chance executives took was to bring them to you in real life, with pop-ups and retail experiences. Previously, for a successful boutique, an e-commerce site was considered an exotic or second-tier way to make money. Now it's the opposite. Even the highest-end boutique, with rare pieces from designers like Five Story in New York, Colette in Paris, or The Webster in Miami, has an e-boutique. Virtual entrepreneurs are also disrupting the food and restaurant business. While Uber Eats and Grubhub ensure you don't have to set foot in a restaurant to pick up your food, a new model threatens restaurants entirely. This model is called a virtual restaurant and shifts away from the overhead required to start a successful business in the field. These restaurants would have no waitstaff and no hostess, just a kitchen to create delicious food, with the idea that ordering online and through app services would be enough to sustain business. The virtual workplace has benefits especially for the small artisan. In the past, people with a talent for making jewelry either made it for friends and family, did it as a hobby without the intent to sell or market, or got a job in a jewelry store. Now, if your stuff is marketable and desirable, you can create your own empire. One example of this are the power sellers on Etsy, like Alicia Schaefer. She began making headbands on Etsy, selling them piecemeal, and now she makes $80,000 a month selling scarves, headbands, and leg warmers. She does it from her home and moves 3,000 products per day. Her initial overhead? Almost non-existent. The rise of virtual entrepreneurs stands to help American women in particular. American women spend a tremendous amount of money, and it's female entrepreneurs who understand how to reach them. Virtual entrepreneurship allows many more one-woman startups to benefit from a new level of flexibility, as they're able to make their own schedules and fall back on cloud services to fill out the enterprise. A recent Harvard University study asserts that the gender gap in pay would be considerably reduced and might even vanish if firms did not have an incentive to disproportionately reward individuals who worked long hours and who worked particular hours. Flexibility is one of the keys to American women's success in business. The flexibility that comes from being a virtual entrepreneur or working for one means that employees are happier too. You might also get better hires. Who doesn't want to work from home in their pajamas? A Forbes article cites a study in which workers' happiness is evaluated on a scale of 1 to 10. The answer to how happy are you at work scored higher for remote workers, an 8.10, versus all workers, 7.42. Americans, particularly millennials, will spend a lot buying from savvy online retailers. Companies that have exploded from virtual-only and smart marketing to young tech-savvy Americans are Warby Parker, Dollar Shave Club, Casper, and Bonobos, to name a few. Both Dollar Shave Club and Harry's, from the team behind Warby Parker, understood that the millennial male and female wanted an easy solution to buying razors. As of 2014, Harry's was valued at $350 million, and Dollar Shave Club was purchased by Unilever for $1 billion. Both companies have millions of customers, thanks to a keen understanding of social media and reach. These tactics are crucial for the new virtual entrepreneur. Millennial-centric eyewear brand Warby Parker did something similar for boring glasses shopping. Picking out new glasses is unsexy, and this online startup, now valued at over $1 billion, made glasses part of your outfit and identity while delivering chic frames to your door. Years later, after starting as online only, Warby Parker has stores all over the U.S. Millennial men are key targets for these virtual businesses. Case in point, clothing brand Bonobos, which made the reverse move to brick and mortar. Their motto? Like most guys, we're not big fans of shopping. That's why we set out to build the best online shopping experience in the world, and we made it the core of what we do. we're now the largest clothing brand ever built on the web in the U.S. Advertising for these online businesses is popping up in well-trod digital spaces like Facebook and other social media platforms, but also in what might seem like the most boring of places, podcasts. Savvy Americans are consuming audio content, and some of the most precious ad space is on popular podcasts with large audiences. Slots are cheap, a few hundred dollars, and they have tremendous reach. With the viral true crime podcast Serial, online mailing list company MailChimp got lucky. They took a chance on what might be a big and savvy audience and became an overnight sensation. Podcast advertising also helped propel the virtual mattress company Casper to scale, allowing the company to make $1 million in its first 28 days in business. There's also money in reselling things you buy in the wild. Nasty Gal founder Sophia Amoruso, a.k.a. Girl Boss, did just that. She started a massive e-commerce site that began as an eBay store where she flipped clothing she bought in stores for more money online. The popular podcast Planet Money recently dedicated a whole episode to these resellers, particularly on Amazon. One such reseller, Sam Cohen, buys stuff at big retail stores, then turns around and sells it on Amazon for a quick profit. It defies economic logic. There are millions to be made from this, as has been proven over and over again. Students ripped off by expensive textbook prices are buying and selling textbooks as arbitrage using online pricing strategies. Founding a virtual business is a microtrend that allows savvy Americans to thrive in a world of automation and globalization. A low-cost way to pay the rent without having to go into an office. You don't need to have a world-changing idea either, just a good one. To be a virtual entrepreneur, all you need is a bit of technical savvy to open accounts online, some marketing moxie, and a small amount of capital. You too, young, old, can become a virtual entrepreneur. Don't expect to succeed on the first try. It might take 4 or 5 ideas, balances on your credit cards, and some stress to figure out what works. But only a few years ago, this ability to quickly fail or succeed didn't exist. You might not be Bill Gates or Sarah Blakely, self-made billionaire founder of Spanx, but with some persistence and the right idea, you can make a decent living or pick up some extra cash. Globalization and technology are not your enemies, but your friends. America should be doing everything it can policy-wise to clear the way for these new virtual entrepreneurs and the flexible workplaces they can create. 45. Microcapitalists. Almost anyone in America today can start their own business, selling their old stuff or new crafts on eBay. It takes a little time and capital to get started, but once you're up and running, amazing opportunities can arise. If you live in many of the developing countries in the world, the landscape is different and the stakes are higher, but the opportunity to make it on your own is on the rise. You may face low wages and few good jobs locally, but if you could leverage the basic ideas of capitalism to your benefit, it could change life for you, your family, and your community fundamentally. If you can get started. Enter the microcapitalists, who've made it their business to disperse seed money in small parcels to entrepreneurs across the globe. Both the model and the returns are astonishing and on the rise. It is not a surprise that Goldman Sachs would make this a major initiative, but it was a surprise that their male-dominated finance firm would focus on women. In 2008, Goldman Sachs announced their 10,000 Women Initiative. With an initial commitment of $100 million, the bank created a program that would provide the most underserved women, from across 56 countries, the financial resources, education, mentorship, and networking they would need to start a business in their local communities. This program was revolutionary. Women business owners, particularly of small to medium-sized enterprises in impoverished parts of the world, have always been overlooked by investors and institutions. At the same time that Goldman Sachs announced its 10,000 Women program, Muhammad Yunus of Grameen Bank in Bangladesh was building on a similar concept of loaning money to the very poorest of his country, mostly women. Some would call it financial inclusion, but most of us now know it as microfinancing, and it would quickly gain traction. Today, microfinancing reaches over 200 million clients worldwide, 80% of whom are women. Yunus went on to win a Nobel Peace Prize for his work in microcredit in 2006. And in 2014, Goldman Sachs' 10,000 Women Initiative, in partnership with the World Bank, announced a $600 million global financing facility that would enable 100,000 women, and growing, access to capital and resources worldwide. Women have been a key focus, not only because they have a notoriously difficult time asking for and receiving money, but also because the International Finance Corporation estimates that 70% of women business owners in developing countries can't get adequate funding, at a gap of nearly $300 billion. In the U.S., it would be perfectly normal and feasible for a female entrepreneur to apply for a small business loan to start, say, a Lululemon franchise. There are plenty of institutions competing for their business, and the lending process is usually quick and straightforward. But in the developing world, where steady employment is a challenge, money is scarce, a person's credit history is virtually non-existent, and often there are few assets to be used as collateral, lending to aspiring entrepreneurs is all but non-existent. At least it was. Now, microcredit institutions have expanded to over 100 countries and benefited millions of the most impoverished. Grameen Bank alone has lent more than $2 billion to more than 2 million villagers in India, most of them women, with an average loan of less than $100. Has a focus on women negatively or positively impacted the process? Muhammad Yunus explained in an interview with the Los Angeles Times, "Based on our experience in Bangladesh, money going to the families through women brings much more of a benefit than the same money going through a man. Women want to build it up for the future. They have a longer-term vision. Women look at the family situation, improving the children's situation, unlike the men who try to concentrate on immediate gratification and enjoyment of life. We saw the same thing in other countries where the idea of microcredit has spread." Goldman Sachs reported positive results as well. Graduates of their program on average reported a 480% increase in revenues. There's a lot to be learned from these microcapitalists, and not just in the narrow sense of what they're doing with their loans. We also learn from microfinancing in general about the successes and failures of lending money, making money, owing money, and losing money in impoverished nations, with or without the infrastructure to support entrepreneurial endeavors. In Bangladesh, the birthplace of microfinancing, most women began by taking out a small loan to buy a cow to sell milk, or they would purchase materials to sew and sell saris. Then women began pooling their money for larger projects, say, to buy a herd of water buffalo or to open a bakery. Now, years later, women-oriented microfinancing initiatives have grown into grassroots movements and self-sustaining organizations that are alleviating poverty, not just for themselves and their families, but for entire communities, while also empowering future generations of women. Take, for example, Mamta of Hyderabad, India. In 2006, she started a company that would clean water tanks in her community, a much-needed business. Her customer base started with 200 locals and grew to a regional 4,000. She now employs 15 people and dozens of contract workers. Her business is expected to grow by another 30% over the next few years. Latin America, with its well-established microfinancing programs, has benefited greatly from this financing development, which has become important to the overall economic outlook of developing countries in the region. The Economist published its microfinance business environment report, which found that 8 of the top dozen countries with the best business environments are in Latin America. Peru led with a $12.3 billion microcredit portfolio, followed by Ecuador, $1.7 billion, and Colombia, $1.4 billion. Mexico had 2.3 million clients, making it the largest market in the region. Microfinancing is changing lives not just in India and Latin America, but globally. Rural women in East Africa, for example, have been accessing microloans throughout the poorest parts of Uganda, Tanzania, and Kenya to support AIDS orphans, start small businesses, and pay for school fees, food, and health care. Borrowers further help communities by using funds to hire helpers and create local improvements. In Pakistan, where two-thirds of the people live on less than $2 a day, and ancient cities have been demolished by war and terrorism, women have started storefront businesses, are creating incentives to rebuild infrastructure and housing, and are focused on keeping their children in school. Investment banker Roshana Zafar has been trying to stamp out poverty in her hometown and the surrounding neighborhoods of Lahore through microfinancing since 1995. She has given over $200 million to more than 300,000 women. Money goes toward embroidery businesses, salons, schools, infrastructure, etc. The biggest impact, reported to Zafar, "We've discovered that 40% of men interviewed say, 'We have stopped beating our wives,' as a result of the loans. Because most quarrels are over money, lack of money. A whopping 80% of men say they now consult their wives in not just financial decisions, but all decision-making." Even in the United States, where Grameen America reports that 28 million people have no access to banking services, and less than half of us have a savings account, women, particularly Black and Hispanic, are finding new opportunities in microfinancing. Overall, the largest impact of microfinancing communities has been in education. Muhammad Yunus, founder of Grameen, explains, "In Bangladesh, we lend money to women, and they're all illiterate. Their husbands are illiterate. We wanted to make sure their second generations are not illiterate. We made it happen. 100% literacy in Grameen families. We gave them education loans so they can go to universities, colleges, medical school. We have a whole new second generation with high education. It is built into our system." Unfortunately, despite the numerous success stories, there are just as many tales of borrowers who built up debt they couldn't repay. Africa, for example, has not attracted as much attention or capital as, say, Latin America, due to political risks and weaker infrastructure. A successful microfinancing model doesn't just require a person with an idea and aspirations to run a business. It requires the overall macroeconomic health of a country. With a failing economy, fewer recipients are able to pay off loans. Interest rates are high. There is less training available. And many borrowers end up rolling unpaid loans into new loans, a revolving door effect. Donor programs intervene, but many of these organizations function with a kind of flavor-of-the-month giving mentality. Direct funding, rather than funding through an organized government or regional program, has created increased uncertainty for many microcapitalists in the region. And more often than not, businesses are forgotten or abandoned, and eventually fail. With a couple of decades under its belt now, the microfinance industry is estimated at a value of somewhere between $70 billion and $100 billion. According to the 2015 Microcredit Summit Campaign Report, by the end of 2013, microfinance institutions reported reaching 211,119,547 borrowers. This is the largest number ever reported. On the other hand, the total number of poorest clients with loans outstanding declined for the third straight year to 114,311,586. Of these poorest clients, 82.6%, or 94,388,701, are women. Studies revealed that people in developing countries manage their households in far more complex ways than economists thought. By looking at overall income and expenditures, researchers were overlooking the day-to-day struggles of the poor. Researcher Jonathan Morduck explains in Portfolios of the Poor that when someone is living on $1 or $2 a day, that money isn't actually earned each day. It could be weeks before their next payment. Therefore, households might not be making long-term choices with their income, but rather providing for immediate needs. In developing areas where microfinancing is being allocated and properly managed, and where businesses and grassroots organizations are taking shape and impacting communities directly, poverty levels have decreased dramatically and quality of life has improved. Still, as independent economist Kathleen O'Dell points out, microfinancing is no silver bullet. The overall effect on the incomes and poverty rates of microfinance clients is less clear, as are the effects of microfinance on measures of social well-being, such as education, health, and women's empowerment. Another side benefit of microfinance is simply the introduction of the ideas of Adam Smith into communities that otherwise would think of economic gain and loss as more about what the tribe or the government does. Of course, failed microcapitalists could become even less enthusiastic about these ideas, but success stories provide inspiration that capitalism works, and not just for the big companies, but for the little guy or woman. In the U.S., due to all the issues related to red tape and taxes, opening a small business often moves people toward the Republican Party. We don't know what becoming a microcapitalist does to people's political views in developing countries, but anyone with a business anywhere needs economic, if not social, freedom. Microfinancing might not be the cure-all for global poverty, but it is here to stay. When it fails, it generally leaves people no worse than they were. But when it is successful, it can make a huge difference to people and their lives. There is no minnow tank, that is, a smaller version of popular show Shark Tank, for people taking microcredit. But a splashy reality TV show may well be what's needed to bring even more attention to this way out of poverty. Unlike a handout, these ideas are meant to teach people how to fish for a lifetime, which is why they are so powerful when they work. 46. The Fakesters. Fake news became all the rage after the 2016 presidential election. And yet it only served to pull the covers back on a whole new world of fraud that had been developing over the last decade. A new kind of con man that could pick your pocket without ever coming within 2,000 miles had been created. The Internet Fakester was born. Many Internet Fakesters represent a new kind of criminal far removed from the great bank robbers like Willie Sutton and famous mobsters. Even the great criminal fakesters of the past, like Charles Ponzi, or the more recent Bernie Madoff, needed to confront their victims and look them right in the eye. While the Internet has created incredible benefits for society, it also has allowed this new underclass to develop and prosper. When hackers came on the scene, it was mostly out of sport. MIT students coined the term hack in the 1960s to mean a person who delights in having an intimate understanding of the internal workings of a system, computers and computer networks in particular. They were nerds, geniuses, recluses with a lot of time. Movies were made, legends built. Sarah Gordon, senior research fellow at Semantic Research Labs, has been tracking the mentality and motivation of virus writers and hackers for years. Gordon explains that hackers today are a varied bunch. A good number of fakesters fit the stereotypical mold of the adolescent male computer nerd. But with the changing of the internet, she explains, hackers don't necessarily match one profile, one skill set, one demographic, one geographic location. Nor do they have to be people with an advanced understanding of computer systems. In fact, most hackers get their tricks from, where else, the internet. On its simplest level, skimming cash off the internet became easy once internet platforms opened up to provide cash to virtually anyone who could provide clicks. As we've seen, that created fascinating new careers for some hard-working and creative people. But it also opened up the internet to this dark side. Simply splash a few false headlines with a picture, and if you get enough clicks, ads and checks will follow. Post the fictitious Clinton bites dog or Trump pisses on Pope, and bam, great headlines garner clicks. Come up with hundreds of those, and the easiest scam ever created could start to multiply. The best place to be a fakester is a location where no state police or FBI are likely to burst through the door and arrest you. That makes it hard to maintain in the U.S. and impossible in China, unless the government is helping you. However, many countries remain prime real estate for a fakester operation. Places like the Ukraine, parts of Africa, and the Philippines. According to cloud service provider Akamai, Indonesia faces the largest number of cyber attacks, 38% worldwide, followed by China. only 1.7% of all cyber attacks are targeted at Russia, much lower than the United States, Taiwan, Turkey, and India. One fake news distributor in America, Disinfomedia, run by Justin Kohler, was willing to talk to NPR. According to Kohler, he runs many faux news sites, a number he would not pin down, with anywhere between 20 and 25 writers. Kohler is a soft-spoken 40-year-old with a wife and two kids. He says he got into fake news around 2013 to highlight the extremism of the white national alt-right. The whole idea from the start was to build a site that could kind of infiltrate the echo chambers of the alt-right, publish blatantly fictional stories, and then be able to publicly denounce those stories and point out the fact that they were fiction, Kohler says. He wrote one fake story about how customers in Colorado were using food stamps to buy marijuana, and his news made it all the way to the Colorado State House. State representatives were proposing legislation on something that never even occurred. Kohler continues writing fake news, undeterred by the reaction to his interview. Stories about fake news garner $10,000 to $30,000 a month. If Kohler targets Trump supporters, he makes much more. Like other cons, for fake newsters, the money comes easily. Their identities can remain hidden, and best of all, the identities of their victims remain hidden. In the past, a con man was a con man. Today, a con man can also be the guy you just bought your insurance from. According to Martin McKay in his 2015 piece, Researching the Psychology of Hackers, if you go to DEF CON in Las Vegas or Chaos Computer Club in Europe, you'll see hundreds of examples of the lone hacker, tattooed and wearing a dark hoodie. But for every one of those people putting on a public show, there are tens if not hundreds of people who spend their time breaking systems for fun and profit. Many of them are successful business people, wearing a suit to work every day, looking and acting no different from everyone else. To some people, committing crimes using a computer is as much a 9-to-5 job as protecting computer systems is. But fakesters have plenty of other routes. Last week I received an email that asked me to wire $25,000 to a man I'd never met before in Nigeria in exchange for a larger sum of money later on. It's the classic email scam, replete with the odd spacing, odd writing, claiming dire straits, known as the Nigerian Prince story. These are so bad and so obvious, you kind of wonder why people even bother. But they must send out tens of millions of these and get a rate of return that is good enough to live a pretty good life in Nigeria. On the other hand, John Podesta and the Clinton campaign IT operation fell prey to a rather simple phishing scam. According to Mother Jones, Nigerian fraudsters manage to dupe Americans into forking thousands of dollars over to complete strangers each year. In 2011, the FBI received close to 30,000 reports of advance fee ploys, called 419 scams, after the section of the Nigerian Criminal Code that outlaws fraud. The agency received over 4,000 complaints of advance fee romance scams in 2012, with victim losses totaling over $55 million. Nigerians aren't the only ones committing international advance fee fraud, but nearly one-fifth of all such scams originate in the West African country. The scams often involve phony lottery winnings, job offers, and inheritance notices. Two fakesters who were interviewed for the Mother Jones article admitted they are each worth $60,000 in Nigeria, a country where 70% of the population lives on $2 a day. Surprisingly, phone scams are on the rise too. There are now call centers with 400 to 500 people running scams, and almost all of the calls come from India. They account for 10% of consumer complaints to the FTC, and over 250,000 complaints in 2016. With advancements in the robocaller, billions of fake phone calls to both cellular phones and landlines are placed every month. Apple has documented one common scam in which the victim receives a call instilling panic and urgency to make a payment by purchasing iTunes gift cards from the nearest retailer, convenience store, electronics retailer, etc. After the cards have been purchased, the victim is asked to pay by sharing the 16-digit code on the back of the card with the caller over the phone. Amazing what sometimes works. One of the more frightening and lucrative scams on the rise is ransomware. Ransomware acts like malware, but once it enters your computer system, it locks your keyboard to prevent you from accessing your hard drive until you pay a ransom. Usually in Bitcoin. According to Wired magazine, ransomware has been quite lucrative. In 2012, Symantec gained access to a command and control server used by the crypto defense malware and got a glimpse of the hacker's haul based on transactions for two Bitcoin addresses the attackers used to receive ransoms. Out of 5,700 computers infected with the malware in a single day, about 3% of victims appeared to shell out for the ransom. At an average of $200 per victim, Symantec estimated that the hackers hauled in at least $40,000 that day. Extrapolating from this, they would have earned more than $394,000 in a month. Overall, in 2016, it is estimated that the fakesters took in $1.33 billion from the U.S. market. There are probably 100,000 people in the fraud industry, and it's one of the fastest-growing jobs in the planet. It's done mostly by young people in developing countries who may never know a better career, and the skills needed for much of it are diminishing rather than increasing. Just as our airports today require enormous resources poured into security, so too does the internet need to develop in the same way. Much of this crime is not about technology, but about preying on our emotions. No security has ever been developed that guards against the basic human instinct to help someone you believe needs help, or baser flashes of curiosity or greed. It will take a concerted effort to curb the fakesters. But this is one microtrend I hope stays a microtrend. 47. Work with limits. The attention deficit generation can add to a new kind of work to its mobile lifestyle of casual dating, shared living, part-time schooling, and the notification-driven culture generated by smartphones and social media. Part-time and after-school work has been around for a long time. Generally, part-time work arose when full-time work was cut back by employers who needed to save money given a reduction in orders. Some part-time work, like the seasonal work around Christmas, was intended to deal with cyclical retail patterns. After-school or summer work fit nicely with the breaks people had from school. However, there is an emerging microtrend that we call work with limits. We're not talking about part-timers who are looking for full employment. We're not talking about college-age employees balancing school and work. And we're not talking about the 60 and older crowd working post-retirement jobs. We're talking about Americans in the prime of their careers who don't want their work to be the defining factor of their lives. This runs in stark contrast to the rest of America slogging away at their desk jobs. For these workers with limits, WWLs, work is not everything. It's only part of their lives. About 25% of part-time workers live in poverty, according to a study by Rebecca Glauber, a professor at the University of New Hampshire. However, this particular set of part-timers are finding ways to cobble together gig economy jobs, maybe driving for Uber during the day, delivering for Seamless at night, in order to create the life they want, with the schedule that they desire. It's a way of working that's meant to work for them, not their employer. Many of these WWLs are women, ones who don't necessarily have to work due to their financial situations, but choose to dabble in fulfilling and productive projects that don't take up all of their time. This allows them to spend time with their families or pursue other interests. For WWLs, it's all about finding fulfilling work that speaks to a passion or allows you to find a work-life balance that you can control. While these WWLs might be finding time for their passions, it's become a worrisome trend for the Federal Reserve. The metrics produced by the Bureau of Labor on monthly employment data are closely watched by all industries to understand where the economy is headed. Yet, while the part-time workforce is at high levels, according to Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that of the 26 million part-time employees in the U.S. in 2016, 20 million of those actively choose part-time work. Of those, 6 million chose to work part-time to pursue their passions. When it comes to full-time work versus part-time, American men vastly prefer full-time work, unlike women. In a survey from 2011, only 12% of men preferred part-time employment, whereas 60% of the women preferred it. However, part of this gap is due to the stigma of men taking a back seat in their careers, particularly if it would make them feel like second-fiddle husbands. Regardless, part-time labor in America is growing quickly. Between 1955 and 2015, the number of Americans choosing part-time labor quadrupled. As the labor force has contracted, this group has expanded. It might seem as though part-time work were bad for the American economy, but that isn't necessarily the case. According to Diane Lim of the Committee for Economic Deployment, OECD research indicates that part-time work allows for greater freedom of movement of workers across jobs, occupations, industries, and geographies, and lets resources flow more easily to their highest valued uses. In other words, part-timers allow for a more fluid economy and the creation of jobs that are constant and evolving. Part-time jobs also aren't resulting in a decrease in productivity. Instead, this influx of part-time work brings relief to the economy from pressure on automation. Let's not confuse those who work with limits slackers either. Many studies show that part-time work is a solid strategy for both companies and employers, as these tightened schedules result in happier employees and a better work product. Currently, 2/3 of part-time employees are women, and 1/3 are men, with half of the men coming from the oldest and youngest age groups. Overwhelming evidence shows that part-time work benefits American women. A study from 2012 evaluating the happiness of women between part-time and full-time work found that decreases in working long hours brought positive and significant improvement for the lives of women who participated. Many of these female part-time workers have children and a full-time working spouse. Maybe they are seeking out intellectual stimulation or want to dip a toe back into their old work lives without sacrificing their home lives. Startups have begun to take notice of the flexibility that women with children want in their lives. Companies like Inkwell, which matches high-level small projects with qualified women who have left the workforce to have children, have sprouted up, enabling a marketing executive with 2 decades of experience to take part in fulfilling work that also allows her to spend time with her kids. These companies and initiatives run counter to the brain drain, the idea that educated American women drop out of the workforce to have children and don't return, that can slow women's rise up the corporate ladder when they want to put their families first, but also to continue their work. The WWL lifestyle is an advancement for working moms. Companies that offer flexible scheduling or part-time work at a high level are bringing many moms back into the workforce. Many companies are taking notice and catering to those who really want to spend only a limited amount of their time on work, and 1/4 of all working American women now work part-time. Companies that don't have part-time options will fall to the back of the pack and lose their competitive edge for hiring the best talent. Slowly but surely, industries that were once notoriously inflexible with work hours are realizing the benefits of compromise in this age of connectivity. A recent National Study of Employers report found that 38% of employers offer more work-from-home options, up from 23% in 2008. While commonplace part-time work might be a trend to watch in the future, more companies now offer flexible arrangements, telecommuting, and shorter workdays than ever before. Although some of these benefits are offered only to certain employees, particularly women with young children. Many American men want to work part-time, but feel that it might make them seem emasculated. A study found that 59% of working fathers would love a part-time schedule, but don't do it because over 1/3 said that part-timers were looked down upon at their organization, according to Fast Company. This bias might be keeping part-time workers from participation on big, essential projects, or from gaining the full respect of their coworkers. This may continue to change in the coming years, but flexibility in the workforce will be driven by employers, not employees. If companies see this as a way to save, perhaps through fringe benefits or to tighten the wage gap between men and women, or to simply allow less stress on employees and more time with family, then change will come from the employer's culture. Perhaps rewriting the employee handbooks is in order. Among many young Americans, the ideal is to avoid working for large companies entirely, and to be able to keep some control over their time. millennials are obsessed with the idea of working on their own schedule, which might mean fewer traditional company perks, paid vacation, health benefits, in order to feel like your own boss. According to a recent 2015 study by PayScale, only around 15% of 2015 college graduates want to work for large corporations. Whereas a large banking job or position at a global firm was the keen desire of a rising senior in college in, say, 2007, that's now considered unappealing. The study also found that things like wanting to spend time with a loved one, to feel passionate about one's work, and to travel the globe all trumped the desire to have the security of a full-time corporate job. This was reinforced by a career builder study that found that 63% of respondents agreed that a full 8-hour workday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. was an outdated concept. Velasco, 2015. The 9-to-5 workday doesn't fit the modern family structure, period. Before, this setup was intended for a two-parent family, where the man was at the office and the woman was at home. Traditional industries and traditional schedules aren't taking into account the delay of modern marriages, or workers' desires to pursue personal interests, let alone a two-parent working home, same-sex marriages, or even the prospect of a woman working while her husband takes care of the kids. Even structurally, new additions like a lactation room or an open office setting hint that the old way of work is simply not applicable for modern times. According to a 2015 study, more young men are looking for part-time work than ever, indicating that the stigma felt by older generations of men is either going away or not potent enough to outweigh the other priorities of men entering the workforce. This trend is also likely a reflection of a new generation of men who seem to be participating more in what economists call household production, aka duties on the home front. This hints that the gender gap in part-time work may close in the future, and that companies will need more innovative paternity leave. The desire for a more flexible job and personal life isn't just American. In the Netherlands, the majority of married women have a part-time job and are happy with it. In a 2013 Booth and Van Aars study, the findings indicated that partnered women in part-time work have high levels of job satisfaction, a low desire to change their working hours, and live in partnerships in which household production is highly gendered. While women in countries like the Netherlands are still managing the home, they're not upset about it. In European nations like Spain, the United Kingdom, Germany, and France, governments actually emphasize part-time work for employers as a way to cut costs and employ more people with less commitment, citing from the Booth and Van Aars study previously cited. Employees in part-time situations were the most satisfied, according to a 2012 study, surpassing the job satisfaction of regular 9-to-5ers. And part-time work also makes you more efficient and effective. This arrangement is somewhat confounding for social planners and government officials, who define full employment as everyone working the longest possible hours in exchange for clear benefits. But more and more workers say part-time is enough. On the whole, WWLs are not trying to climb the corporate ladder or buy a Tesla. They view work as necessary, but want limits. 48. The new factory worker. The new factory worker is just as much a creature of the information age as the traditional factory worker was of the industrial age. This new factory worker profile couldn't look any more different from the old one. In the 19th century, jobs and industry in America were structured around family life, health and safety, work hours and overtime, and being part of a collective organization and structure that would protect you, your children, and your spouse. Today's new factory worker is built around the always-on economy and the greater flexibility demanded by new millennial workers. Factory workers used to stand on an assembly line doing one arduous and tedious task day in and day out. Maybe this meant screwing in one part of a toy or placing one item in a basket over and over and over again. The new factory worker runs a forklift in an Amazon warehouse or works independently for an app like Uber and still has a challenging job, but it looks very different. Traditional factory jobs that were the bulwark of the old economy are disappearing, not just in the United States, but globally. All over the world, the manufacturing base of employment is shrinking, even as productivity has increased. Many believe that we are nearing the end of work as we know it. In a narrative that goes like